You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Now, before we go into this one, I just want to tell you I probably did as much research before this interview as I've done before any of the interviews that I've had on the show, partly because Richard has created so much work and I wanted to be well-versed, but primarily because I was a huge fan of his as an adolescent and consequently was super nervous to be asking him questions about his life as if he was a real person in the actual world and not some sort of weird totemic reflection of who I once used to be. So I was a bit giddy before the interview. I think I dreamt about it the previous night. I certainly woke up thinking about it, which isn't like me at all. As many of you will know, I'm normally one of those kind of badass, couldn't give a fuck road warriors. Very unlikely to be nervous. Anyway, the reason I'm highlighting some nerves, which I otherwise largely managed to hide, is to excuse the inexcusable fact, of which I'm terribly embarrassed, that a couple of minutes into the show, I actually forgot the name of writer Alan Moore, who's one of my favourite writers and comic writers. I didn't just forget his name, I panicked, and I think I referred to him as the Watchman guy. And this is the sort of thing that's going to make future Stu very cross and ashamed. And I tried to edit it out, but I was prevented by journalistic integrity and a lack of skill. And it's also made worse by the fact that Richard Herring sort of says Alan Moore in a tone of voice that quite rightly condemns me for being an idiot. But before we launch into the show, I just want to point out I was nervous, and that's why I blanked on someone I love very much. And anyway, if I didn't know who Alan Moore was, then how come I knew what he said about the Lost Girls and was able to use it in a perfectly appropriate example of what we were talking about? There. Well, suitably vindicated, honour restored, here is an interview from the very room where the man himself endlessly plays himself at snooker and podcasts the results. This is a conversation with the extraordinarily funny Richard Herring.
It's about time I did another snooker podcast. I haven't done one for about, every 3 weeks at the moment.
I asked for questions on Twitter, so is there any sort of burning issues? And I've got a lot of people making reference to sun cream and ham hands and stuff. I think people want to know if you've sucked your own pot, if you've seen a ghost, if your siblings have, all of that. I thought I'd steer clear of all that kind of stuff, because although I'm pleased that our audiences overlap, I think there's a chunk of mine who are just going to go, what the hell? But someone did one request. It wasn't a question. It was tell Richard, please stop doing the snooker podcast, which I listened to as much as I could bear of an episode. And I was really excited by, I really like, you know, in the blurb for it, it just says, this is the most self-indulgent thing you're ever going to hear. And I suppose once you said that, it's like, there we go. It's like calling something artistic, like, what's his face? The Watchman guy,
Alan Moore.
Alan Moore, of course. He was talking about when he wrote The Lost Girls.
Yeah.
If they called it art, everyone would have gone, this is porn. Yeah. And they went, this is porn. And everyone didn't have a leg to stand on. There's something similar with the self-indulgence.
There is. My wife also hates it. My wife thinks I should stop. The figures have gone. They just had the figures through for it. And the first episode had like 35,000 downloads. And the latest episode's had 5,000 downloads. It's only gone up twice. It goes down. Episode 29 goes up a bit for some reason. Okay. Then down, and it's just gone up again on episode 35. So it might be about to turn the corner and go back up again. Okay. Let's hope not. When I got down to near zero listeners, I'll stop doing
it. I was going to say, that's presumably part of it. It's like nearly there. Absolutely just going to kill off the last few. Amazing. Well, thank you for taking the time out of your insane, what I imagine is an insane schedule.
It's a little bit busy at the moment, but it's okay.
This is sort of my first question. Aren't you knackered?
I sort of do get knackered every now and again, but I seem to be able to kind of push onwards. I'm not at the moment for some reason. I think just because I've only now got the Edinburgh show to do, it almost feels a bit relaxing because usually I've got like two or three things to do. I'm sort of used to just going on and then for about 6 or 7 months and then having a couple of weeks off and then getting back into it again.
When you have a couple of weeks off, do yeah. you have some sort of physical shuddering breakdown? What I'm getting at is you are more prolific, I think, than almost anyone I can think of, certainly anyone that I've interviewed,
yeah.
in terms of you're constantly putting things out.
Yeah, I feel like I waste loads of time still, so I still feel like I sit around doing nothing all day. So even now when I'm writing my Edinburgh show, or should be writing my Edinburgh show, it seems to be 4 or 5 o'clock before my brain starts kicking into gear just as I'm having to head out to do the gig, and then okay. I don't really have time to do anything, and then I get to the gig. I usually write the show sort of on stage, although I've got quite a lot of scripted material that I'm having difficulty learning at the moment, so which is maybe why it's sort of slowing down. But I don't feel like I overwork. There have been times when there was one weekend a few years ago when it was my wife's birthday. I was doing 2 episodes of Richard Herring's Objective, the Radio 4 thing, mm-hmm. that I had really yet to write. Mm-hmm. And then on the Monday I was doing an As It Occurs to Me. So I had to write basically 3 radio shows in the space of, well, you know, 2 radio shows and a podcast in the space of a week, and go to my wife's birthday party. She was my wife then, which was my girlfriend then. And that was quite hectic and difficult, and kind of went a bit mad. But generally, you know, As It Occurs to Me sent me a bit mad. That was kind of the deadline of that was a bit insane. But I like to keep busy, and I like, you know, I think the reason I do all these podcasts is because, you know, 10 years ago or so, no one was really interested in paying me to do anything, or not very much. And I just thought I'd rather get on with it. And it's great to have this sort of, I mean, if that's a stand up with the podcast, it's been 5 or 6 years, I guess, but just having that outlet to try stuff out and do whatever you want, I think is fantastic. Okay. So most of them are pretty easy to do. Most of them I don't take much time on.
Sure. So okay.
Most of them last about as long as they take to do, you know, something like the snooker podcast, I literally
sure.
just do it. I don't plan anything at all, as you might be able to tell. But that for me is what's the beauty of it, is that it's kind of completely improvised, and then occasionally something funny will happen, but a lot of boring things have to happen first.
Okay.
And so I think the joke with that is that the audience, you know, that I'm doing it is the joke.
Yeah.
That I
yeah.
continue to do it as a joke, but the audience are part of the joke, because the audience who listen also are wasting their time listening to it in a sense.
Sure.
And I think if you get that, then it's quite an entertaining, amusing thing. Out of all the things I do, it's almost the thing I'm most proud of. As I said, my wife absolutely hates it and thinks I should stop. She overheard me doing the last one and just said, "You are. That's what you're doing is just mentally ill."
Okay.
But I think it isn't, because I know that it, you know, I know.
You're aware of what the joke is.
I think if I was doing it without any awareness. But I think that's part of the fun of it as well, is it, have I genuinely or crazy, have I not? So something like that doesn't take up a lot of my time. It's only in terms of, you know, whether I have time to sit down and do it. You know, sometimes I feel I should be writing my Edinburgh show rather than doing the snooker podcast, which is why I haven't done one for a little while. But I don't feel like, you know, I get tired at during Edinburgh. That's the most tiring time of my year. The touring last year was tiring, because I did it on my own, and I've mainly toured on my own without a tour manager and without support.
Sure.
So it's just the driving is destroys you, basically.
Yes.
The actual doing the show, you know, and then doing the show. And I sort of realised on the last tour that I couldn't, that for the show to be good, I couldn't really afford to be doing all the driving myself. I did a bit mm-hmm. of it, but I didn't do it. So I had a tour manager this year, which made things a little bit easier. I feel like I waste a lot of time. I feel like I've got a lot more ideas and things I'd like to get out there that I haven't got time to do.
Okay.
So
do you think that you're a workaholic?
I don't know, because I don't think I think I'm quite lazy. I'm a procrastinator.
That's what workaholics say.
I'm a procrastinator, and I did a show on Radio 4 that was about all these things years ago. That was about these various things. So I kind of am both. There's an element where I'm a workaholic, and there's an element where I
sure.
waste a lot of time.
And
I just enjoy what I do, you know. And it's not, most of it isn't very taxing, and most of it is really fun to do. Something like the Less Square Theatre podcast is just a joy to do. You know, you do like a day's prep, and then actually most of it goes out the window, and you just mess around and have a nice chat with someone who's funny. And you know, that's out of the things I've been doing recently, that's probably the most successful single project I've done. So
It's really nice to have all these different outlets. So I suppose the fear that you get to a fear that you're overexposing yourself, but people can choose what they want to listen to. So,
yeah.
So they make that decision themselves.
Okay.
And also that I could be doing something a bit more worthwhile with my time than some of
them. Is that a concern?
Well, you know, sometimes I worry that maybe I should have been writing more TV scripts. And I've written a fair few that most of them haven't got on, or working a bit harder on, you know, on an individual project rather than spreading myself more thinly. But I actually just think if I did that, I would just take a lot more, you know, I'd just take the same amount of time to do whatever I was doing. You sort of, you know, you have ideas for kind of films and books, and it's a massive commitment to write a book or a film. I'm sort of starting to get to the point where I think, well, like, I'm just going to get on with it. A few years ago, I thought I worked with the guys from Little Britain. I script edited the last series of Little Britain. Whatever you thought of that, it wasn't my fault because I didn't really do anything. Okay. I can either take the credit or the blame for what happened because I didn't really have any input to it. But I sort of saw them, and the BBC were kind of censoring them a little bit. And I sort of thought, why don't you just make Little Britain on your own and put it out on the internet and then sell it to the BBC and they have to put it out? Why are you going through all this?
Okay.
You know, you've got enough money now to do this. Why don't you just make it yourself and have all the money rather than giving some of the money to BBC? But then I got to the point where I thought, you know, recently, the last couple of years, I thought, well, actually, I'm doing okay. You know, I'm working hard, and I'm from the touring and the DVDs and the various TV appearances and stuff, I make enough money from that to comfortably live and to, you know, to support the 70% of work I do for nothing, which again I think obviously feeds in.
Is that fair? Do you think it's a fair tally, the 70%?
I'd say, yeah, I think probably at least 70% I'm doing initially for nothing, and then I might get paid for it down the line. For example, like a lot of this year's Edinburgh show comes from my blogs, which I've obviously written for free.
Sure.
But you go through that and there's this massive wealth of material and you find all these stories. And
sure.
So I could do, you know, it's practically just 6 or 7 blogs I've picked out and then I'm working up. There is a bit of extra stuff, or it can go to a Metro column, or I'll get a radio show or whatever, you know, so it pays for it like that. But I also realise I am in the position now where, not to the extent I can make Little Britain on my own, but I can start making my own shows and funding them myself.
Sure. Yeah, I've heard that story. I've seen various, and I should say I've done more research, I think, for you than any of my previous guests, partly because I'm sort of slightly in that thing of like, oh my God, it's Richard Herring. I ran around a college shouting egg like an egg. You know, partly there's that. But also just because there's so much material out there about you and predominantly by you.
Yeah.
That I was sort of thinking, well, I don't want to ask something that's really obvious. And as you just said there, well, I did a show about that, or a TV show about that a few years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, do you feel like you are using up everything, you know, particularly with your daily blogs?
Yeah.
Do you feel like you're churning through every single thing that happens to you, every memory, every childhood experience? Is it draining? Do you feel like you're using everything?
I think it's quite liberating, and it's quite nice to make comedy about yourself, and, you know, for you to be the butt of the joke, which I usually am. I think it's sort of interesting to. It wouldn't have happened without the blog. You know, the blog's sort of an interesting development. I guess in terms of, there's been 2 or 3 things that have happened in the last 10 or 15 years since, you know, me and Stu stopped working together that have sort of helped redefine what I am, because I wasn't really interested in doing stand-up on my own at all until sort of that 10 years ago. I did some right at the start of, and then the sort of double act took off and I wasn't really interested in working on my own. But the blog was just sort of came about by worrying that I really was. I just bought this house. I'd earned some money from working with Al Murray. I'd wrote 2 series of... I wrote 35 episodes of a sitcom and was well paid for each episode. And suddenly, for the first time in my life, had some money, because we never made money, really, with Lee and Henry. We sort of paid off our debts almost by the end of it. And then I went through a bit of a period thinking, oh, what's the point in working? What's the point? No one seems to care. You know, Lee and Herring had sort of failed and no one really noticed. I thought Time Gentleman Please has been really good, but no one seemed to have noticed. And I sort of gotten in a bit of a sulk. And then I was writing Talking. I mean, I was still working and I was writing the Talking Cock book in this house on my own. And it was sort of difficult. And I just sort of felt I was wasting lots of opportunities, and just think all those days that go by that I've done nothing.
You said that was difficult.
Yeah,
was it the solitude?
I was a bit lonely.
I don't know how, if you've ever listened to this podcast, but yeah, that's the sort of thing we love, because all of my listeners are kind of also in the Anna am yeah. I trapped in that kind of.
Well, it was a difficult point at time, and I bought this house, and it's quite a big house to live in with my girlfriend at the time and her son, and then we'd broken up, and I still was living in this big house. Which is not a terrible problem to have in a lot of ways, except that I had a big mortgage to pay as well. I was just sort of, I was you know, I've always been a little bit socially awkward. I'm kind of better now, but I found it difficult to even ring up my friends and say, let's go out, because I didn't want to impose on them and stuff. So I was staying in a lot, and I was writing a lot, and I was writing about Cox a lot. I was writing a book about Cox, and I was writing a film at the time, which never came off, about someone getting sexually transmitted disease. And so I was just
I don't know who I did last summer.
It was based on a Glenn Wool routine, that, so it sort of came from a true thing, and then it was going to be about this guy having to go back and find all his ex-partners and work out what this mystery sexually transmitted disease was.
So you were writing about a single man in a predicament.
So and you know, I was I'd lost direction a bit. Obviously the double act had stopped, and then I'd moved to this area because Al lives here, and I thought I'll probably be working with Al on something else, even if not another series of this thing. And then Al said, oh, come on, I want to do this next thing on my own, which is his prerogative. But you know, I sort of was a bit lost and didn't know where I was going, and I just sort of felt I was really wasting a lot of time, and days were going by and I wasn't doing anything, and I was just sort of sitting around watching telly and, you know, playing, well, pretty much playing internet poker at that stage, but that sort of thing. And so just the blog was just thought, well, all these days go past and all these little things happen that you don't document, and so it'd be nice just to document one funny thing a day. And it's called warming up, because I thought that will then make me, once I've done written one thing,
I'll do the real writing.
Of course, all that happens and still happens is I do that and go,
and then now I'm done.
Well, you feel like you achieved something, but then, you know, I have suddenly achieved, you know, I've done it for, I'm about 100 off 4,000 entries of that, 4,000 consecutive entries of it, which is, I know it's insane and I know it's sort of slightly OCD, but it is this, it's a really interesting record to have, and it's a really interesting source of material to have, as I'm finding, you know, I put death into the search engine on that, and then all these things come up, and some of them are about me dying on stage, but some of them are things I've totally forgotten. And the Metricolon coming out this week is about an old man, which I got by putting death in for some reason, I don't know, and a kind of middle-aged guy just apropos of nothing passing me in the street and going, oh, I haven't seen an arse like that for 10 years, and me looking around and this quite an ordinary looking woman walking past, but also about the, you know, about all the kind of complications of why we shouldn't look at people's arses and all that sort of stuff. But it's a really good blog that I've completely forgotten everything about, and I don't remember the incident, I've never remembered it, and I read it and it's this really funny little, you know, and I think the Metro column is really interesting, just get everything into 600 words. You can really tell nearly every story in 600 words, and I'm very fastidious about making it exactly 600 words.
Okay.
And sometimes I'll get something out of a blog and go, it's 1,200 words, this isn't going to fit, but you knock it all out and it's 600 words.
Sure.
And I think for writing the Edinburgh show, I kind of realised, even to write a Metro article about each routine, to get it to 600 words, even if you then expand it out again or mess around with it, that's quite a good exercise, I think.
How much of your Metro column, say, or your Edinburgh shows even, is stuff that hasn't ever been part of the warming up blog?
Not very much. The Metro columns are nearly all either old ones or, you know, or newer ones that I'm doing. So, because if you're writing about the week, it would be very odd if something funny enough to be a Metro column hasn't already made it into the blog. Though occasionally it isn't. With the Edinburgh shows, it depends. I mean, with Hitler Moustache, that was... I guess a lot of it ended up being in the blog, but that was more of a... you had an idea and then you ran with it. It came out of the Collins and Herring podcast, though. With What Is Love Anyway, again, I found three or four things. There was a couple of things I'd written around that time, which is part of the reason I went into the love thing. So I'd written them with a view to taking them. I think it's, say, for example, Hit Moustache, I think that my own personal favourite of my own routines is the why liberals are more racist than racists.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever wrote that as a blog, but that was a routine that was kind of bubbling around in my head for about 4 months before I could even... And I kind of knew there was something there, but I couldn't really get it down. And I was quite nervous about attempting it without working out what it was, because also it's an area where it could go badly wrong if you get it wrong, and eventually that did come out. So that wasn't, for example, that was never a blog or anything. But a lot of the love show was. But then again, when you get on stage, I had a routine that was, I think, based on an old blog, and then that suddenly reminded me of it was about when I used to go out with Julia Sawala, which was this kind of, so, and it was about the spirit guide. I'd done this routine, and then I kind of just one day, apropos of nothing in the show, told the story about how when I met her, she had never seen Fist of Fun, so she didn't know that I'd built a shrine to her, and how I kept putting her off watching this, you know, pretending I didn't have the tapes, so I didn't want to see it. And then when she came, first met my parents, she kind of, my dad had a copy and we watched it all together, and I realised that, you know, it's a really funny story for so many reasons, but I'd never thought of telling, I never thought of doing it. It was just something that occurred to me on stage to tell that story, and I realised that was a better story than the story I'd originally told. So that was never, so sometimes the blogs will push someone forwards. I suppose the first one that really, I wasn't doing stand-up right when I started writing the blog, probably for the first two or so years of it. And then I suppose I went back a little bit or found bits. And occasionally, you'll get tweets or emails from people going, oh, I love this one. And I guess one of the first ones that did that was the yogurt. Thing, which again is quite a short blog, so it does change a lot in performance, but you sort of realise, oh, I've got something there, and then you can take that. But I would never have thought of doing, even if I was doing stand up, I would never have thought of that incident where I went to a supermarket with 9 yogurts and the woman said someone likes yogurt. I'd never thought, oh, I'll make a stand up routine about this.
Sure.
But because I was forced to write a blog about that, I think I even sort of, a lot of the time I sit around going, oh, what happened? Nothing happened, there's nothing, I've got nothing. A lot of the time I'm just sitting writing or failing to write in the day, so there's not much happens in your day. And so because you have to really focus in on something minute, you'll suddenly hit something, and then sometimes it doesn't work, and sometimes you hit the ground running. And if you look at the Someone Likes Yogurt blog, it's a pretty solid.
Yeah,
the logic of it all worked. Given that I don't go back really and rewrite these as blogs, so I'll just write them. If they're really good, I might go. I'll go back and just edit it and check if I can make it a bit better. But basically, I just write a stream of consciousness, and some of them just come out bang. That's a routine. The thing I'm doing in this year's show, there was an old lady. I'm doing a thing about the song. There was an old lady who swallowed a fly. Well, again, something I've pretty much forgotten about that I wrote 10 years ago as a blog. but if you read, I've just been basically reading the blog out. It's very well structured and as a routine.
Presumably, your blog has become better structured as you've become better at writing a blog.
I think I've become very good at writing, 600,000 words pretty quickly and making it work as a piece. If you read over them, there's quite a few little mistakes and stuff in there. And if you go back over, when I do take them to write the Metro column, but if I take one to write the Metro column about it, it will change and I will improve it. And but basically, it's that taking it down. And both me and Stu have always loved expanding stuff beyond its natural lifespan. But I think.
Yeah.
But there's something really to be said, even if you do that, I think there's something really said about getting something down, a story especially, or a routine, down to its absolute bare bones, and work out, and I think 600 words is probably, it might make the sort of perfect stand-up routine as well, I think, really. It's fun to stretch things, but actually I think it's also it's more challenging in a way to make something as precise as possible without it being a one-line joke. I'm not really good at one-line jokes, but if you could make one-line jokes, that's fine. But it is, I think that's the breakthrough this year, is thinking of, stand-up routines in that way, that let's, there was one that I was telling that was a blog about me, that again I have turned to Metricon, and then probably in the show about me, a friend who's in hospital borrowing my Scrabble cartridge from my Game Boy, and then him nearly dying and me worried about whether I was getting my Scrabble cartridge. But I was doing that just as the blog, and it was quite long, and then I rewrote it as a Metro article, and then I started doing the Metro article, and if anything I've taken a little bit more off of it at the moment. But it's actually, you kind of find the more you compare it back to the bare essentials, better the story works, and then it works, and then you can go off on a tangent.
Sure, because you know what you're going to say on stage. It goes from A to B to C, and then you can take your time.
I think once you know it, it becomes a lot easier to mess around with it. And I will still mess around with these things right until the end of the tour. But I'm kind of getting more interested in brevity than in stretching stuff.
Will your audience be relieved?
Possibly will. The snooker podcast, given that may go on indefinitely, is my chance to do that. But then I think the old lady sort of fly, for example, is quite a long routine. But it is quite interesting. But I wrote things that weren't intended as stand up articles, because I was just writing things that I was trying to write. Funny stories, or just find something amusing in the day, or failing that interesting in the day, and so it was quite an unusual way to come at it. But a lot of them do really work as stand up, which I then started in about 2004. I came back to sort of starting to do stand up. So it's been an amazing resource to have this blog.
Yeah, I was going to say, given that you have that, given that you've spent, like you say, close to 4,000 individual sessions. Forcing yourself to come up with something, squirreling it away, and then being able, like you say, I'd never thought you could type death into effectively the database of it, search all your previous blogs. And is there a part of you that's thinking, I've bloody nailed this? This is what everyone should be doing.
Well, I think everyone should do it. If you want to become better at doing whatever, if you're a writer or a comedian, if you want to become better at it, just do it a lot, And so I think that's why I've got good at basically having a conversation with someone, is because I've spent hundreds of hours either having a conversation with Andrew Collins or with the Edinburgh Fringe. I've done 50 Edinburgh Fringe podcasts. I've done 25 Leicester Square Theatre podcasts. I've done a couple of hundred things with Andrew Collins, plus the radio shows I did with Andrew Collins. So you get good at doing stuff by doing it, so you become a much better, however good you think you are. I think it's quite interesting, this guy complaining about executives, which is a fair thing to do, about them messing up his John Warburton messing up his
sitcom
and asking for vampires and stuff, which obviously is some idiot. That's a pretty idiotic statement. But he was pretty convinced he'd written a brilliant sitcom, and that was the thing that jarred for me.
Sure.
It's because I write a sitcom now and I'm still not convinced. And I go, I'm pleased with this, I'm glad about this, but I'm not writing a script going, this is perfect.
Were you ever when you were a younger writer?
When you're younger, you are less open to criticism, and it's a knee-jerk reaction to just immediately go, no, this is the best way to do it. But to become a good writer, I really think you need to listen to everyone else. If you're writing something like an ensemble thing that's like a sitcom or a play, you've got to listen to how they do it, at least, because when I was writing Tom, Jane, and Please, and I wrote 9 episodes of Tom, Jane, and Please in 10 weeks, it got to the stage at the end, because we were given 9 extra ones, and it got to the stage where I literally had to, they'd record the episode, I'd have been writing for a couple of days, the next day they would do a read through of whatever I'd got.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rewrite that over the weekend, we'd do another read through on the Monday, I would then finalise it by the Tuesday, they would then rehearse that for 2 days and do it on the Thursday, I'd be starting the next one. And the read through, you know, you would get so much from the initial read through, however good you thought it was, and you could take stuff out, and I think you've just got to listen to what everyone else says. But I think as a young writer, it's very easy to go, no, I'm brilliant. However, if you are brilliant, that's great, but you'll get better by doing more. Sure. and really by listening. If you're surrounded by idiots, which you often are in TV, then that you don't have to take what they say.
Mm-hmm.
But I really think it's worth considering, because your knee-jerk reaction is going, no, that's the best bit. There's no way I'm taking it. That's the most fantastic thing about it. You know, he was quite obsessive in his article that the brilliant, you know, the thing about his sitcom was that it was in a pub but you never saw the bar,
which
I can't quite understand what he's getting at there, but he thought this was amazing. But you know, it isn't necessarily that amazing.
Sure,
your amazing idea might not necessarily, I can't see how that was an amazing idea to never see the bar. I don't think anyone would even really notice.
Yes.
But maybe there was something more to it than that, but you know, I'm not knocking him, because I can understand it. But well, he gave up after this one knockback.
Mm-hmm.
He stopped being a writer, which I think shows, again, you're not going to be a good writer if you've got to really take the blame. You know, I've been doing this for 25 years. Most of the things I give in get rejected.
Yeah.
Most of the things I give in are definitely better than the worst things that get on TV.
Okay.
But you know, there's no way of knowing that from the script. Even if you're fantastic, even if the script's amazing, you get the wrong director, you get the wrong actor, just something goes wrong in the wrong way to shoot it. Or there's so many things that can go wrong. But I just don't think you'll ever write a pilot script that's never been read out and never been with it. Because every time I kind of slightly resent the way they make you write sort of what they think is a perfect pilot script.
Mm.
Because the minute it's read out, you go, oh, God, we don't need those 4 pages.
Yes, sure.
That someone could just look at them each other in a, you know, and that will cover it. And you get the right actor. Or if the actor can do, you know, sometimes you'll write a line or say it's a catchphrase for a character and they can't do it the way you want to do it, and mm-hmm. you're like, oh, they don't get how to do the joke.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be a brilliant actor doing other stuff. So you've got to get rid of that joke because the actor can't do it. Or doesn't get how to do it, and you can't go, no, do it like this.
Sure,
because they'll get cross, and also they still won't understand. So just sometimes you just got to let things go for, you know, pragmatic reasons. But, you know, I just don't think you can... If you're sitting thinking I've written a brilliant script, then either you're an absolute genius,
mm-hmm.
and I think this is true of stand-ups, they're kind of the absolute best ones, and the absolute worst ones have this unbelievable belief in themselves.
Okay.
That they just have this confidence. So you see the genius ones and they're just like, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life because this is brilliant, I don't care if the audience don't get it. And the absolute worst ones have the exact same massive confidence. I think most people in the middle don't know, you know, you don't know, you're fairly confident you're okay. The more you do something, you go, well, I must be okay at this because it's going on. But you still can't be sure.
So what can I say about Richard Herring? He's an incredibly prolific writer, blogger, columnist, talker, as you can hear, the undisputed king of the podcast in the UK, and a comedian whose work I've been enjoying in one form or another since I was about 17 or 18 years old. We spoke for 2 hours and something, so I've split this podcast up into 2 episodes. The next one will be out next week, probably. I think I should more generally say next time, but seeing as it's the second half, I'll make the effort. It'll be out next week. We cover but Richard's work with Stuart Lee, his finding contentment without the fame, the riches and the awards that he once craved, what it means to him to move on, his aims for his podcast, the development of his comic persona and what that means to his real self and his real life, and whether it hurts him ever to turn so much of his life into comedy. Some of that in that in this half, some of that in next week's half. And on the subject of weeks, you'll have noticed I've had a bit of a gap. I've been dithering basically over whether to go back to bi-weekly editions of this show. It's just loads more work doing weekly shows, and I can't help noticing that very few of you seem to notice when I just had a pause of 2 weeks there, and an awful lot of you that I meet out and about are saying, I love the show, but I've got a bit of a backlog. I think that's true of most of you. I want to keep it regular, but I just don't know whether weekly or bi-weekly. You don't care, and I haven't made a decision on that anyway. I'm just flagging up that I don't know what I'm doing. So the two things really. The winner of the game, Very Alderton, naming tribute acts for comics, is Sean Bennett, who won the public vote by a landslide with Laurel and Hardley. He isn't going to Edinburgh, however, so a ticket to the Edinburgh ComCom show of your choice, which was the prize, is going to go to the runner-up. So whoever sent in Benny Reboot, you've just won yourself a ticket to whichever ComCom live show that you'd like at the Edinburgh Festival. I just can't remember who you are, and I've Googled you within my mail thing, and I still can't find out, so please send me an email. And finally, before we get back into our conversation with Richard, the latest lineup is available at comedianscomedian.com for the Edinburgh show. The recent editions, about which I'm very excited. Some of these I've mentioned before, some of them are brand new in the last few days. Thursday, August the 1st, that crucial, all-important first show up there. I'm so pleased to be welcoming Hal Cruttendon to the show. He'll be explaining just how you can triple, quad and quin up your gigs of a Friday or Saturday night. In fact, we might not even mention that because I'm sure he gets loads of shit from it from various places. But the truth is, the man is incredibly hardworking and a brilliant, brilliant comic. One much given to being amazing and then coming off stage and going, oh, they were a bit hard work. He's one of those idiots. I think we're going to get along famously on the show. Thursday, the 1st of August, Hal Cruttendon. Friday, the 2nd of August, Sean Hughes. Another person, another sort of hero in many ways, who I watched as a kid, who I can still hum or sing the theme music to his show, and who, because of whom, now whenever I pick up the phone to people and I'm in my house, I always think to myself, I should switch some jazz on. So can't wait to welcome Hal Cruttendon on Thursday, August the 1st. On Friday, the 2nd of August, is Sean Hughes. And then some other big guns later on. The rest of the details are up there. Friday, August the 9th. Is Milton Jones. Milton bloody Jones. That's just going to be brilliant. I can't wait. Saturday, August the 10th, Bo Burnham, who is an internet sensation. Some of my listenership, like me, might be a little bit older than Bo's target audience, or certainly the biggest percentage of his audience. But have a look for Bo Burnham on YouTube. I think that's going to make for a fascinating chat. And then towards the end, I mentioned some of these, I think, last week. The 19th is Al Murray. Brilliant. The 20th is Sarah Millican. Brilliant. The 21st is Rob Delaney. Also brilliant. So all of them are up at comedianscomedian.com. That's enough plugging for now. Let's get back to my conversation with Richard Herring.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Acast anbefaler.
Mit navn er Anders Morgenthaler. Over for mig sidder
Roald Bergmann.
Vi har lavet en ny podcast, der hedder Dopaminklubben.
Og Dopaminklubben er en klub, hvor ADHD er fucking sjovt, og hvor det griner. Det behøver ikke at være super alvorligt.
Vi er skide trætte af alle de der podcaster, forklarer mig og nederen der. Vi gør grin med vores ADHD. Mulig ADHD.
Ja, vi udreder mig, fordi nogen siger, at jeg har det. Jeg ved det ikke rigtigt, det finder vi ud af.
Vi har i hvert fald lavet vedmål. Ind og lyt til Dopaminklubben. Hver uge udkommer vi. Der laver vi sjov og spas med at have den her vidunderlige dopaminmangel.
You've described your frustrations over the years with stuff not getting made, things that you felt were good that weren't getting made.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you've kind of, like you're in a position
where you have a kind of a hard won, or, you know, you've earned your stripes in terms of the disappointments that you've suffered.
Yeah, but they don't stop, you know, and that's, but I think ultimately, and like, if you talked to me 10 years ago, I'd have been much more, I'd have been the same thing, and, oh, this is shit, and why is everyone turning my stuff down? It's not fair, I'm brilliant. And I might have been more like that. But I think
for the benefit of the listener, Richard was doing a small dance from side to side as he did that.
But I'm really glad in hindsight that I've had to struggle, you know, upwards in the last 10 years. You know, I've still got to the point where, you know, most people don't know who I am, and most people, and I'm not guaranteed to. I'm sort of in a lucky position that I'll get paid to write pilot scripts, mm-hmm. so I can spend 2 months writing something and it won't get made, and it's not the end of the world because I've still got paid for it.
Sure.
It's still massively disappointing, but I think you need to have those knocks, and you need to look at it and go, well, okay, look, they didn't get that, maybe it was bad, maybe it wasn't, maybe if I come back and look at it in 5 years time I'll agree with them, or maybe I'll come back and look at it in 5 years time and go, actually, this is really good. If I have a hit, then I can go back and pick up these old shows and go, this is another script, and they'll, of course, make them because I'll have had a hit.
Yes.
So there's a lot of, you know, you've got a battle, and I think the battle is a good thing. I think it's, you know, me and Stu early on worked really hard, but had a sort of charmed existence where we sort of went up in this, you know, straight curve up the graph, and every door we got through more or less closed behind us, and we got, you know, we were very lucky to write for On the Hour very early on. We got our own radio show. That, you know, got another radio show. That show, radio show, got to TV. That just got onto TV. You know, we had a little setback when the Fist of Fun got cancelled, but then someone else came in who liked it, and we got the next thing. And, you know, Fist of Fun was the last sketch show that they spent a reasonable amount of money mm-hmm. on the budget. So, you know, we were very lucky to get that. And then we sort of had the bad luck of someone getting in charge who didn't like us, and neither of us sort of really worked. Certainly, in, you know, well, I wrote for Time, Gentlemen, Please, but we were in sort of both in a little hinterland wasteland for 4 or 5 years. But I think it did us both the power of good, because if we just kept on succeeding, I think you'd have got to that level of confidence that I imagine Ben Elton has about himself.
Yes, okay.
That he just goes, well, I've written this, so obviously this is brilliant.
Sure.
And I don't need to go back and look at it and check whether it is brilliant or listen to it. So that's the other end of it, where you get so successful that everything you do, no one can criticise it because you're J.K. Rowling or because you're Ben Elton. You just get to put out a massive book that could do with some editing, because no one dares tell you that you should edit it. So I think having the failures is a really positive thing, and working for 25 years is a really positive thing.
Yeah,
it's bad to get discovered too soon. And I can, you know, when I was a kid, I wondered, you know, when I was a teenager, I was writing to TV hoping to get into things. You know, I was really hopeful that our first student review would be made into a TV show. I completely understand it. I'm delighted it wasn't. It would have been terrible. But also, you know, you become much better at what you're doing. I think that's the thing. And you also understand, I'm much more, you know, philosophical about the failures now. I've written this script, Rara Rasputin, and I don't think, something might happen with it eventually, but it's not looking good. And I'm really pleased. I think out of all the things I've done, I've been getting better and better. I think this is a really interesting idea that kind of ticks a lot of boxes and, you know, would be a good show. And it still might happen, but it might not. And I think 5 years ago, I would have just, you know, I'd have been so miserable. The minute that call came in going, you know, I'm not sure it's going to happen, I'd have been just distraught and going, what's the point? But now I just sort of think, okay, well, I'll move on to the...
And is that because, when you say 5 years ago, is that because that's when you started, podcasting, or when you started sense of, I'm generating stuff on my own that is a success, not dependent on the whim of anyone else?
It's very nice to have that. I think going back to stand-up gave me a performing outlet. So when I was lonely and not doing anything, and I wasn't performing, and I think that was part of the problem. And stand-up is enough for me as a performer. Mm. Even if I'm just doing 30 people in front of a pub, if I did that a couple of times a week for the rest of my life, that would satisfy that urge of being a performer.
Yeah.
I don't need to be like a massive star. I don't need to be everyone to know me. In fact, I'm glad that I'm still fairly anonymous and can go about my life and observe things.
Would it be, can I just stop you there? Because this is the middle of an interesting answer, but something I know that a lot of people will ask, and something that I've thought myself in terms of my own expectations of my own stand-up career. I've been going for 9 years and I make a living from it. I'm very grateful. And I think I can sort of look at my famous friends and go, I wouldn't like to put up with some of those things.
Yeah.
But equally, I think a bigger, large part of me is going, but I'd really like a chance to find out whether or not I liked it.
Well,
in all honesty, do you still want it? Do you still want telly and fame and those accolades and things like that? Or have you sort of made peace with that not happening yet, or maybe ever, in a kind of fairly calm zen way, or have you been forced to make peace with it? What's that?
It's a mixture of all those things. Like, I think, again, 10 years ago I was very sort of bitter that none of our shows had been recognised as being any good. I've never won any stand-up awards. And anything I've worked on TV has never got anywhere near having an awards. You know, some of the internet stuff has now started winning awards, and it did bother me when I hadn't won any awards, and that seemed odd. And it did bother me that people were coming in and being awesome.
When you say that seemed odd, is that because it didn't tally with your view of your own ability?
Well, yeah, I think it seemed odd that we'd done quite a lot of great, good stuff, I thought, and it'd never been recognised by anyone. I'm still, even looking back at Fist of Fun now, I sort of think, well, it's not as good as I thought it was, but there's still something really interesting in it, and given how young we are, there's loads of ideas, and if someone had gone, oh, this is great, here's an award, that might have meant that it existed, you know.
So sure.
We got slightly starting to get recognised in the newspapers with it, but people were very sniffy towards us, understandably, because we were young kids and it looked, you know, Stu's hair looks stupid, and so you can understand it. But, I think also when I was younger, you sort of think of the money and the fame and the girls and all that stuff as being super exciting, I suppose. So, like, I'm a bit older, so I don't want any of that stuff, and I'm married, so I don't want any of that stuff. So that element of it's gone. Being famous to me just seems that, you know, I'm better known again. I'm better known now than I probably ever have been, even when we're on TV. If I go out on a Saturday night, maybe five people will go, "Hey, Rich, love your stuff," you know, and they know my name now. So that's they never used to know my name, but it's not. It doesn't ruin the evening. It's just quite nice. Five people tell you they like it.
That's quite a nice manageable level, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not too bad, and then you move on, and I don't mind that. But I think if it was absolutely everywhere I went, people were looking at me. If I was sitting in a coffee shop, I like to sit in a coffee shop and listen into other people's conversations. And if I was famous, people would be going, "Isn't that Richard Herring? What's he doing in the coffee shop? He looks like he's listening to what
I say." Next blog. Isn't it odd how everyone's always talking about me?
Yeah, so you lose out on all that sort of stuff. I think I'm just more interested in, and I think I always was really, is interested in producing good comedy. As when I was younger, I possibly would hope that would lead to me meeting supermodels who might have sex with me. You know, I also think you look at, and they didn't, I think you look at other comedians' career paths, and and the comedians who've had, someone like Ricky Gervais and maybe David Walliams probably have had exactly what I would have dreamed of happening. So yeah. Ricky Gervais has gone to Hollywood, he's worked with the Spinal Tap guys, he's been on The Simpsons, he's met Larry David, he's worked with Larry David. Those are the kind of things that would think, oh, that's where I'm at, that would be amazing to have all that. David Walliams, you know, has parted and married a supermodel and all those sort of things. And I think, again, as a young man, that might have been what I wanted. But I think, ultimately, at the core of it, I always just wanted to create good comedy. And you know, I was always a comedy fan as a kid and just wanted to make stuff that was good. And that's enough now. So, yeah, having the podcasts and stuff means that I have that outlet. Having stand-up, though, just meant I had that outlet. I think people see things as a step to the next level. You've got to see stand-up, you've got to see every single thing you're doing as an end in itself, I think. So if you're doing stand-up because you think this will lead to me becoming a TV presenter, then you're not going to be that great at stand-up, and also you're going to stop doing it, so you won't have the years that you need to become a really great stand-up. So many people have 10 good minutes, then bang, they're on TV and you never see them do stand-up again. The people you can really say, well, they're a proper comedian, the ones who come back, get that successful and still do the stand-up. If you're doing podcasts in the hope of getting a TV show, again, I've seen the podcasts as an end in themselves. I kind of think if the right thing comes along, if someone comes from TV and goes, "Will you come and do this thing?" And it sounds like it'll work, I would do it. And I'd really like to write TV scripts. But with the Less Square Theatre podcast, I can't really see how you would do anything like that on TV. The reason it works is because it's 2 hours long and you can say what you like and I can ask dumbass questions. Sure. And people are relaxed enough to know this is going out to a very select, tiny group of people, and it might get picked up by the press and the international media if you say you just try to kill yourself. But, you know, on the whole, it's kind of quite an intimate, nice thing, and it works because of that, and it works because you can have this long conversation, which is what podcasts work. You know, you can't do something like this on any other media. Even if this was a radio show, it would be constantly interrupted by other things, and you wouldn't be able to talk at this length. And yet, people love to listen to it. Either casually or as they're doing something else or whatever. So that 2-hour thing doesn't work anywhere else. And if you can make something brilliant as a podcast, why do you need to go on TV? I sort of feel like with Stu complaining about TV shutting people off, you kind of go, well, but the I think TV is increasingly becoming like a sci-fi
system. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
It's fine. It's going to, for mainstream stuff, it's going to still be there for a good time. But if you're doing interesting stuff, just do it yourself. It's, you know, we're going to film. We start filming the Leicester Square Theatre podcast. Obviously, I'm going to make my own monthly half-hour stand-up show that I'm going to write and, you know, in the month and learn in the month and do in the month. It won't be as slick as a TV show, but I think it essentially will be the same as making my own TV show. And I think.
And how are you planning to distribute that? Is that a video podcast?
I'm just doing a video on the video download. So we might do a bit of it as an audio. I think we might do an interview within it that we might put the whole interview out as a free audio. Mm-hmm. But the actual, because it'll take me a month at least to write each one, and I have to do a lot of work. And it, you know, you've got to pay the cameramen and the editors and the producer and the director. So we're charging for it. We'll just see how it goes. I mean, I think it'll lose money, to be honest. The Leicester Square Theatre thing's worked out okay in terms of money. We've made a bit of money. And, you know, we'll plow that back into the next thing. But if it could become successful enough that it made £100,000, then you could start making your own other, you know.
It's a really weird dynamic, podcasting, isn't it? Yeah. And I occasionally, I've spoken to Ben, who produces your show, and some other podcast people a couple of weeks ago at the Chortle Conference. And it was fascinating because we all sort of met each other and went, "Oh, we're all podcast people. What do you use? What's your gear?" We just had a little conversation about the relative benefits of the Tascam and stuff like that. And it's quite interesting to sort of go, "Oh, there's a little subculture here," even though it does seem increasingly everyone's doing them, and you know, there's lots of them about. But I wonder, do you find it's frustrating that you go, "I make this thing, thousands of people, I have no idea what your listenership, but it's got to be the tens of thousands, if not 100,000.
Yeah, we get about 100,000.
Okay,
it,
sure. So that many people listen to it for free, and it costs you to produce.
Yeah.
Can't they just give you a pound each or something?
Yeah. Well, I think increasingly it will start to happen. But I set off doing, you know, I started doing with Andrew Collins, obviously. And for me, it was just the freedom of being able to do what you wanted to do. And I didn't think about it in any kind of business way. I just thought, this is fun, let's do it. It'll be a fun thing to do. It, you know, it's completely, I'd say it's doubled my live audience, the podcast. It's not trebled it. Yeah. So therefore, my income has become a lot bigger because of that. My DVD sales or whatever. So I'm actually doing better financially now, because not because I thought, "Oh, this would be a clever way of making it."
Sure.
So those people, enough of those people do appreciate after 200 hours or whatever, go, "Well, maybe we should give him a tenner for something."
Yeah.
So if that, as long as enough of them do that, and I think with the Leicester Square Theatre podcast, we've, you know, about 3,000 people have downloaded something, right? So it might not be the series pass, but it's one of the episodes or the series pass. We had a little bump from the Stephen Fry thing, which might have sort of doubled our thing. But even 1,500 people is not bad to download stuff. If that's about something like one out of 20 or something, I guess people are download, you know, are paying for something. Mm. So if you can get 20 more people to listen to it, that's one person giving you another £3.
Okay.
If you can persuade 1 in 10 people to do it, then it starts to become more profitable. So I think as people start to understand that if they like this thing, it's not like we're Universal Films and you can download their movie and the movies are still being made. If for the things I'm moving into, if people don't pay for it, it just won't exist anymore. So the audience, because I'll do a series of this, it's Rich Shane's Meaning of Life. I'll do a series, see what the loss is, see if I can, you know, cope with the loss, see if we've made any money. If we make a bit of money, that's fine. If we cover the cost, that's, you know, I'll do another one. But if we don't, we probably won't do any. We won't do any more. So the audience become basically the commissioning editor. So if they enjoy it, then they have to just give, you know, £3.50 or whatever it might be for one episode. Or it's not very much money when you look at it. So like the Leicester Square Theatre series, we did 10. In the end, we got 10 podcasts for £15.
Yeah.
Which, if that was a DVD, you know, it would be a DVD. It would be 4 or 5 DVDs.
Sure.
So I think the problem is that a lot of younger people don't want to pay for anything.
Yeah.
I think older people do, but I think enough people, even with the blog, I think after 5 years, enough people go, "I've read this every day for 5 years." You know, if he asks for £10 for scope or whatever, or £10 for doing this. So you do, it does, it definitely has led to me, and I don't really understand. Like I say, I think I'm probably making more money now, even than possibly when I was working with Al. So maybe not, but, you know, maybe it's enough people, and I can't really understand why. But because I'm doing so much for free, but enough people appreciate it. So I think there is a way of building, and if the audience really understand that the money is going not to funding my luxury lifestyle of taking cocaine and sleeping with supermodels, I'll pay for that on my own. but to plow that money back into making new stuff, I think there's enough people out there that will hopefully make that happen. So you know, I think you can start making anything, but I also think it doesn't matter if you make something on a Tascam or you make something on a video camera and it's all right, it looks okay. That's enough in itself. You know, I think you've got to think of it as an end. If you do something really well, eventually people will come around to you. I don't really understand why. You know, I can't understand what I did that meant I stopped working on TV. I thought we worked really well on TV. We did really good stuff. I was doing really good writing, and then you know, there's been a big sort of wilderness period where it's been back and forth, but it's not like people are ringing up going, come on the TV, Richard, do this.
Sure.
And I don't understand why that is. I don't particularly understand what it is. But I've just thought I'm just going to carry on doing what I'm going to do, and I'm enjoying what I'm doing enough that if the rest of my life was just making the Leicester Square Theatre podcast 25 weeks a year and you know doing a tour, and that's absolutely great.
When you say you don't understand why that is, and that kind of wilderness sort of period, do you have any theories? Do you feel there's a quality you're lacking, or like a look that you're lacking?
You sort of drive yourself mad with that, you know. I don't know because I don't know why all the people I've worked with, none of them seem that keen to employ me in anything. But I'm very friendly with them all, so I don't know. Is it just that they don't think I'm that good? Was I too annoying? We had to work really hard with Lee and Harry. It was quite stressful. It was kind of quite competitive in different sorts of ways, I suppose. So I don't know, but you just battle onwards, and then you get. And Stu battled onwards, and he completely got to where he wanted to go.
Mm.
I think maybe it's partly that I think you maybe need to really want it much more than I do.
Okay,
I think I'm not so ambitious to be famous or massive successful anymore, and I think I once was. If anything, maybe there's a part of me that is resistant to it. So I've been offered a few things that I could have done,
okay,
but I didn't feel comfortable, you know, sort of celebrity based TV show.
Okay, there's a sort of an unwillingness to kind of play the game and be on celebrity juice, say.
So I've turned down things like that I don't like, and any of those kind of. I did a boat race thing years ago, but I kind of worked out that there was enough people in that they couldn't focus on me, and then it wouldn't be a big hit, and I was completely right, and it was an interesting experience to go through.
Does it give you cause to pause when you get invited? Let's just use celebrity juice as an example, or that your programs are that ilk.
Yeah.
Do you, when you get a request for something like that? I mean, presumably you're not thinking, this could be it, this is my ticket back in. But are you sort of thinking, well, this is a choice. If I remember, and I will maybe interview him on a future show, and often when I say, oh, I heard that you said this to my guests, they go, no, I've literally no idea what you're talking about. But with that caveat, I had heard that Phil Jupitus has said, if you want to be on telly, you need to be thought of as someone who's on telly by doing everything until you're in the game. I mean, do you sort of reflect on those?
Yeah, but I don't want to, you know, I'm a comedian. I don't want to do, so I don't really want to be if a nice presenting job comes up, I'll do it, but I don't really want to become a presenter. I wouldn't want, if a nice quick panel show thing comes up, I still do it. I'd be reluctant to I'd really have to think hard about taking on something like Phil has, like become a team captain for 20 years on a show.
Sure.
That, and I'm really glad he's back doing stand-up and stuff now, but you know, it becomes very easy to go, oh, well now I'm making however much money that is for your 17 days work a year, it's certainly enough to live off very comfortably for a year. If you've got a family and stuff, why would you push yourself out and do extra stuff? So I think there's an element of me, where I have had a few offers that if I'd taken different things would have happened. But I don't know, I've done Have I Got News For You, do Buzzcocks, I've done it a couple of times. You know, it doesn't seem to me to make much difference. Stu said that loads of people started recognising him in the street after he was in Buzzcocks or Have I Got News For You. I didn't really notice any massive upshot. There was a couple of people noticed maybe on the weekend. It means, I guess, that it just means in terms of getting other jobs that maybe people go, oh, this is a guy that's been on Have I Got News For You. If you do like a slightly higher paid gig somewhere, that it'll be on the little write up about you. But yeah, maybe it's about not I think people maybe think me and Stu were difficult. I think Stu was probably more difficult than I was in terms of stuff. So I think
I have to say I hadn't heard that. Obviously, at the time you were working, that was
being very, as he is, you know, being very focused on what he wants and not taking any shit from anyone. So I think we maybe both got that reputation within people working in the industry, we were both with Avalon, who also had that kind of reputation, so maybe that put people off. But I don't know, maybe it just is about you've got to be really hungry and push yourself. But no one was really pushing me. I thought I was a good sketch performer and a reasonable actor. I never get any kind of offers of, I only do those things if I write them myself, basically. Sure. Once you're in that gang, then the people think of you. And yeah. When you write a sitcom and people go, well, we need to cast famous people in it, that's the way it works.
Yeah.
So you can sort of see that it's this self-perpetuating thing.
Sure.
But absolutely. I am really glad that I'm not. No, I could easily. If we turned into Little Britain, I'd have turned into a sort of much worse David Walliams figure and probably self-destructed.
Yeah.
Stu would have hated it in different ways. So really glad that it didn't happen to us. If I'd turned into Ricky Gervais, I might have turned into sort of kind of arrogant person who didn't have any idea how he's perceived. So I'm glad that didn't happen to me. And I think there's lots of or if I turned into David Mitchell, who I really like and think does a great job. I think that would have been a different way for me to go. I'd much rather, I suppose, be creating my own stuff. And I guess that's it. Probably so that's probably the fact that I want to have the autonomy to make my own stuff. It's very hard to get onto TV that way now, because I think TV people think of in terms of, we've had an idea, who can we put in it? They don't really like you to come with, I've written this thing
for me,
will you make this? Or a lot of my things for other people, they don't like you coming with an idea. They want to have the idea and put the team together. I think in the old days, they'd put the team together or the team would come together and go off and make this thing. So I haven't played the game in that way, and I've not been keen to write for other people. So I suppose I've made that choice. But I see doing the stand-up shows as ends in themselves. None of them are really... Hit 'em Slash became Richard Herring's Objective, which was a sort of different thing. But they could turn into TV shows. I suppose Talking Cotton nearly became a TV show the first time I did it. So there's an element where you could do stuff with those shows, but they're very much an end in themselves. And that's what I'm aiming for.
It's interesting to hear with the amount of work that you produce and the amount of work that you clearly do, even if you claim to be lazy, even if it's all done in the last 5 minutes before a gig, couple of days. But it's interesting to hear that you might speculate that you don't want it enough.
Yeah.
Because I think that of myself very frequently. I'm a bag of nerves. I feel like I get away with stand-up. I enjoy it a lot of the time. Sometimes it goes badly and I have a horrible time. Yeah. And I spend a lot of time in the day on my own thinking, right, how can I really must work. Like you said earlier on, writing or failing to write. There's an awful lot more failing to write than there is writing. And I do think, beset as I am by all of these kind of the attendant psychological problems of a very isolating, or at times very isolating job, one of the things I end up thinking is, do I want this anyway? Do I even want this? And I think to myself, of course I want it. All I'd need to do is 2 days on a building site or 2 days in an office or something like that. Yeah. But I just wonder about that, the way in which you maybe can't prove to yourself, despite the amount of work you produce, despite the quality of work, that therefore means that you do want it and you're okay and you're just not getting it.
I don't know, I sort of think, in the past, there was loads of times where I wanted to stop completely. I'd have a couple of weeks, and usually in the middle of Edinburgh, I was going, I'm going to give this up and stop. I don't like it. So I want it enough to keep doing it. I think what I want, I think my just ambitions have changed. What I want is to keep on working and making, something around the living I'm making now for the rest of my life, and just to be carrying on performing. And I think so my ambition has just changed. So I don't, and looking at what you get from, even, with Stu, he finds the fame aspect of it very annoying. And I just don't know. I'm not sure that I would want to be under that kind of scrutiny if it was for the right thing. If I was, I think Stu's played it really, really well and deservedly so, and has got a TV show and completely under his own terms, or two TV shows completely under his own terms. And that's an amazing thing to achieve, especially in the current climate. And that's good. And I think if I could do something similar, then I might take it. But I don't think it's hard to know whether you've just decided this is what's happened, so therefore this is what I wanted. But I don't think it was 10 years ago, this isn't what I wanted. I would have felt like a failure. I would have felt that embarrassed. I was much more competitive, and you know, I think when I started out, I wanted to be the most famous and best comedian of my generation. Mm-hmm. I guess that, A, I realised that wasn't probably likely to happen because I met, you know, I've worked with some fantastic comedians. There you go, well, they are, you know, Steve Coogan is probably more talented as a comic than I am, probably, if I were. So, you know, I worked with him very early on, so you kind of realise your limitations. But, you know, it's you realise, I think, there's a lot of luck in it and there's a lot of, that maybe there's a bit of playing the game. I'm terrible at networking and don't remember who people are, and I'm not really interested in doing that. I think I still probably work under, and it's probably from my dad, you just sort of work under an idea that if you do the best, if you work hard and are good, people will recognise that and you'll be rewarded. But that isn't how it works, I don't think. So, you know, there's a lot of luck in, if you look at all the people in The Office, they were very lucky, you know, when you've cast a sitcom, you understand how much luck there is in casting a sitcom. You'll have a part and you go, oh, both these people are brilliant. Who should we choose? I don't know. No, I don't know. What do you think? I don't know. And if we'll go around room to five people and three of them will say one person and two of them will say the other, and that person gets cast. Mm-hmm. So the person who didn't get cast was like, if that had been The Office, that sitcom, they were just a hair's breadth away from being in The Office, and if they're in The Office, then they become like a world-famous successful actor, you know. So mm-hmm. you realise how much luck there is in this, and just chance of being in the right place, making the right decisions. But I think, you know, maybe I'm not saying that if BBC Two came and said, we want you to do, rather than doing the old Meaning of Life show at Leicester Square Theatre on your own, we're going to pay you not that much money really to do it. You know, I don't know. I mean, that's what I sort of think. Even for the money that you would get on TV, the only thing about TV is the exposure, which means loads more people come and see you live. But what I like about my live work is I've gruelled. I mean, I have worked hard at that. And over 12 years, I've built up my own audience of, you know, between 100 and 600 people will come and see me in each town. Or, you know, sometimes a bit more than that if you add them all together. And I've built that audience up through hard work and through them liking me and then telling their friends and their friends liking me and it working and liking the podcast, and it works. If you're then on TV, and Stu's even had this a little bit, people will come along and go, what? I thought he was on TV. I don't get any of this. What's going on? So even if they haven't seen him on TV, they still don't know what he's going to be.
Yes.
Or they just think because he's on TV, he's famous. And you double your audience, you make lots of more money. And I'm sure Stu definitely could play much bigger venues than he does play. But it's then the quality of the experience and also that feeling that I've earned this audience myself, and they're a really brilliant audience who like my stuff.
Yeah,
if they all bring a friend every, there's a few people going, oh, I don't get this, but mostly I'm playing to people who really get my stuff, like me, kind of feel that I'm their little secret, I think, you know.
Yeah.
I do good shows and people, you know, I'll have that a lot of people going, why aren't you on TV, or what's, I don't understand why, you know, this is really good, why aren't you TV? But that's a really satisfying thing to have, and I just think it's the balance of obviously having enough people liking you that you can keep your career going. Mm. So I think I'm not interested in going underground. I'm not like Daniel Kitson. I'm not going, you know, I'm going to keep this secret. I don't mind doing TV. I don't mind doing panel shows.
Do you think that would affect your relationship with your audience if you're their little secret?
Yeah.
Do you think that if you then did a big TV show, some of them might go, everyone knows about it now. I liked Richard Herring when it was cool.
I don't think any of my friends are really cool. So. I don't think it necessarily would make that much difference. I think a lot of them, they sort of invest in me in the soap opera sense of it, I think. So I think a lot of them, when something happens, like when they see me on TV, they get very excited about the fact that I'm doing Dara O'Brien's Very Hard Sums or something.
And sure, tweet because you're their guy.
Yeah, yeah. And so they're kind of behind me. And I suppose because I have documented it so much, they've sort of been through it and they know what I've been through to get to where I am. But, you know, 10 years ago, I wasn't a stand-up at all. I wasn't as good as I am now. So I'm glad this 10 years has happened. And I'm also, as long as I can keep what I've got in a viable extent, and what I'm saying is you've got to trade off a little bit. I think you can't just go, right, well, I'm going to cut myself off from that world completely because I'm not in the stage where I can do that. I think Stuart probably could. Stuart's... Mm-hmm. You know, probably made for life now, even if he stopped doing TV. He doesn't need to do that TV show now. He sort of, I think it's good he wants to do it, but he, you know, he sort of goes, oh, I don't like all the fame and stuff. He doesn't need to do it if he doesn't want to do it, because there's enough people who'll come see him to make him have a very viable career for, you know, at least another 20 years. I think I still have to keep working, but it's definitely got to a much better point. But it's taken, you know, I've properly been on tour on my own for 12 years.
Yeah.
Going, driving everyone on my own, playing to 30 people, having terrible experiences, being very lonely, you know, and feeling like, you know, how can I keep doing this? But I've kept doing it, and I suppose that's the difference. And there aren't many people, there aren't many comedians in the place that I'm at. You're either playing 10,000 or 1,000, 10,000 seats, or you're playing 30 people. There aren't actually very many people who can sort of sustain. I guess I'm probably averaging 300 people a night, but you know, I can do a 500 seat theatre and often fill it, or it depends which town I'm in. But there aren't many acts of that level, because you'll either be much bigger or much smaller. It's quite a rare place. So I think there's about two or three of us in the middle, and there's a few people coming up the back, they're coming in the smaller area, but some of them will just explode and suddenly go into the big area. And I think it's much more satisfying to have built up and played the tiny clubs and play. And I still do tour to some little tiny comedy venues, and then also be able to occasionally play the Bloomsbury or the Nottingham Playhouse or something, which is a massive proper theatre, and experience that. It's really nice to build up. I'd be disappointed in hindsight. I obviously wouldn't know if I'd just gone from the Ballon Banana to playing Wembley or whatever, or playing the O2, because you wouldn't have had all these one in them. Actually, the almost perfect size playing audiences. I think I've played places like the Apollo and stuff in charity gigs, and they're it's a really, really fun room to play. But it's more fun, I think, being in a sort of 400, 500 seat, which is why I think Stu still mainly plays those, even if they play bigger, because you have much more intimate feeling there. But to have built it up and understand that, and to have learnt, and once you've learnt to play to 30 people in an art centre, pretty much any gig is easy after that. So you know, I feel very fortunate to build up, and I feel like I've hopefully got another 25 years in my career. So, you know, who knows what could happen. It'd be nice to get recognition, I suppose, but I feel I've got, it does feel like I've got recognition from the people I want to get recognition from now, I suppose.
Does it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I feel like I suppose my worry 10 years ago was I was just going to disappear, or that, you know, the double act would finish and that'd be it, and then I wouldn't have any more work.
Sure.
Which again, maybe when I sort of started doing all the stuff on my own, it was partly just to show I could do it, but also just get the stuff out there, but also just to carry on working. And so I sort of feel fairly secure in that I can carry on doing this if I want to do it. I feel like within the comedy community, people respect me as a comedian. I think people respect me as a writer. So I've got that. It's not, you know, I haven't got BAFTAs and Perrier Awards and anything like that. But but that is sort of less important to me now. It's still very difficult to watch the British Comedy Awards or the BAFTA Awards without kind of feeling a bit cross.
Really?
Yeah, a little bit, but I'm much better now. I mean, I haven't been to the British Comedy Awards since 1992, so everything I've done from 1992 to 2013 or 2012 has not been considered, none of that stuff's been considered good enough to get a British Comedy Award, okay? Which to me, again, that feels like, given my position in where I see myself in the comedy fraternity,
it feels like a snub.
That feels odd, that I know nothing I've done in all that time has been, you know, so it's only on the hour, basically, was the reasons we went to the British Comedy Awards, which wasn't a good joke. But, you know, that seems an odd thing to do. So there were times when I'd watch the British Comedy Awards and be hardly able to watch it. But I can watch it now. And the BAFTAs as well, you kind of think, I can't really watch the BAFTAs without thinking that's really me, because I don't even have a TV show.
Sure.
But you see your contemporaries doing that well.
Yes.
And you're bound to think, well, was I just not as good as them? Or, you know, so it's very hard to know. But I feel, it is a much smaller part of me now that feels like that, because I feel very happy about what I'm doing. But I think it's impossible to I'm not going to see and go, no, I'm absolutely fine, I never get jealous of anyone, because you still have that in you. But I think I'm so much more in a happy place about who I am, and that's what I mean, like, that I can have a really good script turned down and my immediate reaction isn't to kind of smash things up and go, I'm never writing anything again. And my immediate reaction is to go, right, well, I'll move on to the next thing, or I will just start making stuff completely on my own and not bother with all of this. You know, 10 years ago, I guess I was thinking, you know, oh God, well, I might be 45 and still not be on TV or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm nearly 46 and it hasn't happened, you know, but there's still time, I think, and there's still, and being on TV, I don't think I don't see it as the exciting end point to it all. I think being on TV, I see as being a way to make people aware of the other stuff I'm doing, I guess. So I see that more as a commercial. Yes. Rather than
as a tool, rather than itself.
Whereas when I started, I was I wasn't really into live comedy. I loved TV because that's all I'd had when I was growing up. So I wanted to do TV shows. I wanted to be Monty Python with the young ones. I wanted to be. I wanted to, what I did to be that, you know. And and that, you know, didn't quite, or nearly happen, but didn't quite happen. But now, I just think, well, if I can do, if I got news for you every now and again, or if, you know, if I got like a stand-up show on TV, or if I got a script on TV, then that might feed back into my live work. And but I sort of feel like I want to keep on doing these live shows. I might do them every year now, but now this is the 10th year in a row that I've done a different stand-up show. It starts to get wear. That's tiring. The travelling's tiring.
When you had those moments that you referred to earlier on of feeling like, I don't know if I want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
What did you tell yourself to get back on the horse?
I don't know. I just think I realised I was being stupid, because it was like, there's nothing I can do. So I was sort of, you'd be in the middle of Edinburgh going, this is all shit and it's not fair. I've done this great show and no one knows. And I had a lot of Edinburghs where I think people you thought we were more successful, were even in the industry. I think people thought, oh, they're doing fantastically well. It's like I've not been eligible for the Perrier Award or whatever, the Foster's Award, since whatever, really. I mean, because they view me as being too successful.
Mm.
But A, I was successful in a double act, which isn't the act I'm doing now, which sometimes doesn't seem to matter in the Perrier.
Sure.
And B, you know, it's about everywhere you go, you get 500 people, and I can't, you know, I'll get 500 people in four towns, but most places I won't get 500 people, so I'm not as successful as they think I am. I think, I would just be in Edinburgh feeling annoyed and think, oh, I should do something like go to Africa and help do something useful with my life, but then I would realise that A, I'm too selfish and it's not realistic and there's nothing else I can do. So you would just sort of feel, there's an element where this job can be a bit vacuous and it can be selfish and self-centred, and then in Edinburgh you get even more self-centred.
Yeah.
So it kind of, it sort of implodes into this
solipsistic
kind of nightmare, and then you just kind of get over it once you've realised that you've been a bit stupid, I suppose. But and also I think you realise you can do a bit more if you're doing well with what you're doing. You can do nice things, and you can make people, well, A, you can do charitable stuff anyway, and B, you can educate a little bit or make people think about stuff a little bit. So I think it isn't, I don't feel the job is as pointless and vacuous as I maybe sort of sometimes felt it was.
Okay.
So because I think through doing what I'm doing, I think you're making people think about interesting subjects, and I get really nice emails from people saying that my comedy's helped them in some way or another, and that's, that feels like, well, actually I am doing, even if it's only those five people.
Sure,
because of my podcast, have got through depression or something, unbelievably. Yeah. But I think it is having that. You do have that connection with people, and that's a nice thing. So I do. I feel very, I feel very happy about where I am, and I'm sort of slightly zen about where I am, and I don't really want to. There's an element I feel that in 5 years' time, I might be wishing I could be back here.
Do you really?
Well, either way, because either I'll be less successful, and now I wish I could be a bit more successful, or I'll be much more successful. And again, I've been wishing I could be in this. It's sort of finding that middle ground where you can live your life, make a nice living, do what you want to do, and enough people like you to fuel that, but not so many people like you that it sort of blows apart. Or you have to. If we'd become Little Britain, I think there'd have been someone saying, oh, Rich, you can't do Hitler Moustache because you can't, well, A, you've got all this other work you've got to do.
Yeah.
And having a Hitler Moustache will ruin it. But B, I think people might think it's a bit odd, or people, or someone would be saying to me,
you'll be too famous to explore that idea.
Yeah, and also, you go, why is Ricky Gervais got a Hitler Moustache? Oh, it'd be some crazy joke. So it wouldn't even work anyway.
Sure.
But there isn't. I wouldn't be able to do Me One versus Me Two Snooker. Someone would be taking me, you can't do this, it's bad for the brand of Rich Tone at the moment.
Yeah,
my wife telling me that.
I'm
going to show her that. I want to do a year where I make a living only playing snooker to prove to her that it's a good idea. It may not happen, so I think that you realise you've got to look at the positive of what's happened, and I think that freedom and that autonomy is to me much more important than being famous or having lots of money. And as it is, I've got quite, I've done all right financially through various things, so I can't complain about that.
So what is it? Because I want to move on, because there's loads of other stuff to talk about, your persona and the writing and all of that sort of stuff. But because it seems so particular to you, I've just got one more question about this aspect of the industry, which is that what would it mean to you if you did go up to Edinburgh with this show and you won the main award?
Yeah.
What I'm imagining, I'd be thrilled for you, But like, if you kind of like, you won the award or some other award, or a British Comedy Award or something, and you held it and you went, this is it, finally,
yeah,
what is it that you get, that you crave, that you want so much?
See, I don't think I do want that anymore. I think I really did want it, and I really did want that recognition. I don't think it would be as big a big an issue to me now. I think I'd be really conflicted about winning the Foster's Award okay. and whether I would even accept it. But I think, I don't know, it's a really difficult thing. It's a difficult, because I don't think it's a good thing to have an award in Edinburgh.
No, sure.
Despite all the other stuff, there's all sorts of reasons, but I think it just creates an unpleasant, divisive atmosphere and sort of
turns it all into a competition.
And, you know, and yeah. even I'm not even eligible for it, and it still upsets me. There'll be at least one day of the fringe, it'll still upset me that I'm not eligible for it and I haven't won it. So, you know, that's how insane in a time.
That's just it then. If that is still happening, then you're not as over it as you claim to be, and I'm not
But there's an element, that's what I'm saying, there's a tiny element you watch in these things, but it isn't. It's not like I'd go feel vindicated. I feel vindicated by the fact that I've managed to create an audience for my stuff.
Yeah,
okay. To go to Edinburgh, and if I can sell out most of the time in Edinburgh, that's the vindication. Because I've done so many Edinburghs where I've lost money and no one's come to see me much more recently than you might imagine. Only the last 4 or 5 years it's really got much better. And even last year was quite, you know, I was in too big a room and it wasn't.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it did okay. I still made some money, and it was still. Okay.
I was going to say, when in the hours of Edinburgh was a tipping point for you, at which you actually made money. Because I think the Holy Grail is breaking even.
Yeah. Right? It was only when I did the White Belly, whatever that. I think maybe that was Oh Fuck I'm 40, possibly Menage a Trois. But only because the deal was slightly better. It was a slightly bigger room, and the deal was slightly better. So I made £2,000 or something.
Yeah.
I do. It's actually, once you get to the stage where you're getting 300 people in, which is, I suppose, about my average now. That's however much you're spending, you can make a nice amount of money. And anyone doing bigger than that is making, you know, proper money in Edinburgh, which seems kind of weird. But
it does.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, I think if I'd written a TV show and it won a BAFTA, I think that would feel good. I think you'd feel. But it's mainly just in terms of having the security to carry on working. I think that's. I think the thing that annoyed me about the awards, really, it wasn't like going, I need everyone to love me, although that's nice. I think it was, if you get that award, it means you're allowed to do the stuff you want to do.
Mm.
So Stu winning those BAFTAs is amazing, because I think the BBC might very easily have gone, bad luck, we don't do any more of those. But because he's won two BAFTAs or whatever he's won, they can't really cancel the show.
Yes, I see what you mean. It gives you a little shield, basically.
Yeah, it gives you a little. And it's nice to get. There are awards you think that is, you know. I think the Chortle Awards, I feel very happy when I win those. But it took a long time. There's a lot of years of going to Chortle Awards where I wasn't nominated for anything, or I got a nomination and didn't win. In fact, it's only the ones I haven't been to that I've still never physically picked up an award. Because I haven't been able to go to any of the chores that I've been able to do. I suppose actually the Sony thing, I did get given that at my table by a lady, so that maybe counts. But coming third. But, you know, it isn't that big a deal. But I guess it's, you know, it is just in terms of... It would feel like a shame if you'd worked all your life and nobody noticed it was any good, and it was good. But I think that must happen a lot. And but all the people I like... that I really like, someone like Ken Campbell is probably my favourite live performer, and he wasn't well known, you know, but he would do amazing. I mean, he was well known, but he wasn't like massively famous, but he'd do amazing one man shows, and that's enough. And somebody who worked with Ken Campbell told me that my shows reminded him of Ken Campbell shows, and that was, you know, that's probably better than anything else that you could ever get. So, you know, you get a clearer head about it, and you kind of get a bit more level headed about it, and you. And also, I'm in a place where I have a degree of security about my career and my work that it isn't such an issue anymore. I really think 6 or 7 years ago, I was really terrified that everything I'd done, you know, that I worked really hard to achieve was just destroyed by whatever, by the whim of whoever decided what was going to get on TV. And I'd so put all my eggs in the basket of being on TV that I didn't have anything else. So that's why I had to come back and... You know, I had to restart as a stand-up, basically. So I spent 8 or 9 years doing stand-up, and now I think I'm pretty good at it. But it was It was like starting again with a bit of a leg up.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to leave it there for now, I'm afraid. Next time's show is going to... You see, I wrote time in my notes earlier on, but we've already established it's next week's show. I've just got to pull my finger out. It features the second half of this interview, in which we're going to focus on Rich's Edinburgh shows, his place in the comedy community, and the state of the industry, and the state of the industry looking forward as well. So lots of really fascinating stuff there. Thank you very much to Richard. Thanks to Dan Melrose and Graham Crockford. Oh, dear. Thanks. What's this? Episode 46 is the first time I've made that mistake. I'm not going to be too gutted about myself. Thanks to Dan Melrose and Graham Crockford. Get your Comedians Comedian Edinburgh tickets. Most of the guests are now up at www.comedianscomedian.com. 5:15 daily in the Gilded Balloon. I will see you there. And there's some exciting mystery ones yet still to be announced. Speak to you soon.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.